All right. I want to welcome everyone to another episode of the Charity Charge podcast. We're doing this one actually from the road. I'm in beautiful Aspen, Colorado, and sitting across from me at the Little Nell Hotel is Shannon Meyer, the Executive Director of Response. Shannon, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and Response?
Sure. So Response is the only organization in the Upper Roaring Fork Valley working with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. It was founded in 1983 by a group of six women involved with the Aspen Women's Forum, and they looked around and realized there was no resource for what at the time were referred to as battered women. So they formed this organization. It was all volunteer. Eventually, one of those women became the first part-time executive director. After a couple of years, interesting story, one of the board member's boyfriend was a taxi driver, and he took these guys from an Aspen hotel to the airport, dropped them off, and as they were leaving, they leaned back into the cab and gave him a couple $100 and said, "Can you go back to the hotel room where you picked us up? There's a woman there who might need some help." And she had been sexually assaulted by these guys. And he called his girlfriend and he said, "I know you're involved in this organization that helps women." And she said, "Well, we don't help sexual assault, but now we do." And so they added sexual assault services, and that was in the late 80s. Back in the day of all volunteer work, those women sheltered women in their homes, sometimes for a month or two at a time. And then over the years, the whole movement around domestic violence and sexual assault professionalized and standards changed. So that's, you know, considered dangerous in many ways now, but the heart was in the movement at that point, and still exists today, but things are much more professionalized. We've added staff over the years, and now for the first time in 2019, we've had 5 full-time staff all year, which is super exciting.
And I think I really appreciate that you shared, you know, the context and the story there. I think that obviously the mission's incredible, how it started, and then also as the need has been found, it's evolved. What I would like to highlight, if it's okay with you, is I know we were sitting down and chatting one-on-one before recording. I think a lot of times there's always the front-facing mission of these organizations, and that's what the community itself sees. But a lot of times it's the behind-the-scenes kind of operations and inner workings of an organization that needs to be in sync, that needs to be working properly for the nonprofit to actually be fulfilling on their mission. So one of the topics that I think is really interesting, you were talking about the transition of when you were initially brought on board to be the executive director of Response. I think that there were some things that you mentioned that you said, we got to do it a little bit differently. And I think a lot of times there's just legacy things that are carried over. I think one of the things you had mentioned is that there were, in the previous 7 years, 5 different executive directors.
I'm the fifth.
You're the fifth.
So
okay.
The founding executive director left, and in that 7-year period, there were 4 executive directors and then me, which is actually pretty typical when you have a founding director for that long a period of time. It's just clunky finding the replacement. The board has not had to hire before, so sometimes they make the wrong call, or a lot of times a founding director honestly doesn't take a living wage salary for themselves because it's been a labor of love. So they try to hire someone at that same salary, and a professional person with experience just can't make it work. So they actually found me from a different sector. I have a background in private land conservation, but I've been in the Valley, the Roaring Fork Valley, for 20 years, and I've been running nonprofits for a lot of that time, or advising nonprofits. So I came with no domestic violence, sexual assault experience, and lots of nonprofit management experience.
And what were, when you came in and you said, all right, I'm gonna be here and run this, and I really want to have this organization, Response, thrive and be able to serve its mission, what were some of the things that you saw that you said, this is what we'll need to do to take it to the next level?
I think the biggest thing that I saw, and I remember sitting down with my board at my very first board meeting and saying, you have an image problem. This organization does amazing work for a small segment of the community, but if they weren't there, our whole community would be a lot less of a healthy place. And you need to find a way to educate the community about the fact that these issues exist, but also about the success stories that we create every day by working with survivors. So that was one. I said, you know, unfortunately, I think Response is the best kept secret in the Valley right now. We need to change that. Another thing is that people really, in focusing on the positive, we're not spinning it. We do have success stories every day. But the other positive is that we don't want to be in this business forever. We don't want to be serving survivors everywhere because we don't want people to be experiencing domestic and sexual abuse. So Response had been starting to work in the schools doing prevention education. Really, the only way that we're going to end this relationship violence is starting with our youth. And we really needed to highlight that in our public front-facing message. So in my first year, we actually changed our mission from just supporting survivors to working with our community to end domestic and sexual abuse and supporting survivors.
I want to really, first of all, just stop and acknowledge that because that is such an amazing big picture mindset shift that I think a lot of nonprofits can learn from. And it's basically, how do we put ourselves out of business?
Exactly.
I think about it a lot personally, like running Charity Charge, because it helps put you in a framework of how do you want to keep innovating and hopefully adding more value to the people that you're serving. And I think very much so how you're thinking about it from the nonprofit standpoint and mission focused, you want to put yourself out of business, you know, and that's ultimately the goal here. It's a really incredible mindset shift.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important for the community to understand that shift in culture has to start with the kids. And so I have written several letters to the paper. We're saying, you know, we're in the schools, we're talking to your kids, we're teaching them starting in middle school about healthy relationships, we're talking to high schoolers about the difference between sexual harassment and flirting. Honestly, sometimes they're pretty confused about that. We're talking to them about the importance of consent in relationships. And we're talking about sexting, all these things, but it's so important to get the message out that we can't be the only ones talking to kids about this. So we're trying to talk to the whole community and get that conversation going so that it's like, join us in educating your kids. Join us in this mission of working towards a zero tolerance for gender-based violence in our community. We're a small enough community. That's not out there to imagine at some point in the future that it's just not a problem that we're dealing with anymore.
I'm really appreciative. You know, when we were chatting one-on-one before this, that part hadn't come out. So even just as I'm sitting here with you, and obviously other people will listen to this and understand that, I really appreciate your community aspect of trying to bring people, you know, all kind of touch points into what you're doing. I think that a lot of times organizations can become very siloed and feel that other people that maybe are organizations rather that are doing similar work or could be doing similar work are competitive, but very much so I can tell from you, I mean, stepping into the organization, thinking about it both from this preventative piece and then also how do we rally the community together to make it, it's not about response, it's about the mission,
right?
Top level, which I think sometimes organizations can lose sight of. And I think what potentially I'm hearing, which is a normal progression, it's no knock at all, but a lot of times when you take that, you know, founder-led nonprofit organization, some people, you think of like entrepreneurs are really great at starting a business and the idea, but then when you think about scaling and becoming like a huge organization, it's really tough for people to be able to stay in and make that transition. And I think one of the things that you're bringing to this conversation and obviously bringing value to response is coming in once they had already started the mission, had some success, had gotten things off the ground, but how do we think a little bit bigger and how do we really take this to the next level? So I think it's wonderful to hear those thoughts.
Biggest ways that we're taking it to the next level, I mean, on one side, we're changing our mission to let the community know that our end goal is to work ourselves out of business. But in the short term, survivors do have many challenges in this community. And as any working person in this community will tell you, affordable housing, access to and affording it is a huge issue for everyone. So if you add into that being a domestic violence survivor, it's a massive challenge. So less than a year into my tenure at Response, I took a big risk and applied for over $500,000 in grant funding to start a housing program for survivors for us. It was a big leap. It increased our budget by 40%. We added a staff person. We had some pretty high metrics that we needed to meet for our funder to say, yes, in fact, we need this money and we're spending it well. We started the program in April. We had a goal of serving at least 20 survivors in our first 12 months of operation. So less than 6 months in, we've served 25 survivors and 27 children through the program. So we've doubled our metric in half the time. So it's shown us that the need here is huge. Domestic violence is the leading cause of homelessness for women and children. And on the flip side, fear of losing affordable housing and safe housing is the number one reason that victims don't leave their abusers. So for me, that was just a no-brainer that that's an area that we needed to be active in, which we had not been before.
I'm really glad you brought that up because it helps candidly for, and I'm being a little bit, whatever you want to call it, like gender, not bias or whatever, but like as a man, I haven't been a victim of sexual assault. I haven't ever, you know, assaulted a woman or anything of that sort. So I'm removed from this. This is very educational for me to understand the full spectrum of how people's lives are both affected through sexual violence, but also sometimes the kind of upstream what may lead to it. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, this reminds me very much so when I've talked with, you know, executive directors that are running shelters for, you know, people that are homeless, like mm-hmm. all the things that happened that basically put them in a state of being homeless and then how that, you know, the implications both for themselves of being homeless and also on society. I also think a lot about, you know, we work, for example, with Austin Diaper Bank and like, it was so interesting. I mean, I initially just saw it as a surface level. I think a lot of people see organizations just for what they are, like the mission. So I, you know, walking in there, I was like, oh, this is great. You give diapers to families and mothers that can't afford diapers. Great. But what I didn't realize is all the effects of like, you can't afford diapers as a parent. And then, you know, even what would seem like not little things, but then your child has rashes, then you can't afford like medical bills, then it just creates this whole like perpetual problem. So that's being really long-winded. Can you just walk us kind of through like the cycle of like, again, on the surface there's domestic violence, but what's happening upstream and what are kind of some of the bigger like effects that happens to someone?
Well, I don't want to scare you, but you said, you know, as a man, you haven't been exposed to that. And actually, one in four men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. It's higher for women. It's more than one in three women, but it is prevalent. The majority of our clients are women, but probably 10% of our clients are men. So it does affect all genders, all races.
How do you define it? What's kind of like the scale? Because maybe it's happened and I haven't even
And actually part of that change to our mission was shifting from talking about domestic violence to talking about domestic abuse, because a lot of times abuse is more than physical or is not even physical. It's financial, it's emotional, it's psychological, it's abuse of pets in the home. It's, you know, 10 million children are exposed to domestic violence each year, and that's considered child abuse. So for a child to not have a hair on their head touched, but to see their parents screaming at each other or you know, dad screaming at mom or dad throwing the pet against the wall, that's child abuse. That's something that we have to report because of that impact on the kids' health, their learning, their showing up at school, they're physically getting to school because of the constraints on them. So back to your question, which was very broad.
It was, but I think I was just so interesting to hear, like even when you were talking about the housing situation, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of times why you were saying individuals would stay in a state where they're continuing to be abused is like fear of loss of like losing their housing or things mm-hmm. of that sort. So I guess it was just a long way of saying it's like such a broad spectrum. We just think of like, when I initially candidly thought of like domestic abuse, I thought of it as like, you know,
a
verbal
eye.
Abuse or like a black eye.
Yeah.
But the reality is like the problem can be perpetuated because it's like economic for economic reasons, or it's a lot bigger than it just appears on the surface.
Absolutely.
Which I think
we see it in so many different
and
ways.
And even which I think is helpful, like just in this recording, like when you actually then took a moment to explain to me the different areas, I went, yeah, of course I've been, mm-hmm. I've seen this firsthand, you know, with myself.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we have a 24-hour crisis helpline. And we have volunteers that work that on nights and weekends, and it rings to the office during the day. And I got a call from the crisis line once, pretty early on in my tenure at Response. And the woman literally said, I don't know if I deserve help. He hasn't hit me yet. And for me, that was like right in the middle of when we were revising our mission. I was like, this is so important that people know that you don't have to have a black eye for it to be domestic abuse. You know, our slogan, our tagline is love should never hurt. And there's so many ways in which it can hurt to be treated in that way. And really, domestic abuse is about power and control. There's this kind of famous in the field power and control wheel that talks about, you know, domestic abuse is not, it's not about what happened to them as a child. It might have been influenced by abuse in their family. It might not have. It's someone's need to have control over someone else, whether that someone else is a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a husband or a wife or a child. And there is usually a cycle where it escalates. It's more like a spiral. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I went on a first date with you and you hit me, there wouldn't be a second date. You would be charming. And then you would get me into your realm of control. And over time, you might start looking at my phone. You might start restricting where I go. You might get violent when drunk. And the victim is, it's increasing over time incrementally so that they're able to make excuses to themselves to stay in that relationship to a point where they are pretty enmeshed with that person. Maybe there's kids, maybe there's housing, shared housing, maybe there's just the social, everyone knows you're with that person, and it becomes harder to leave. And then the abuser escalates as they know that you're more isolated from resources that could get you out of that situation. So we are that resource that people can reach out to. And we can help people see. We never tell people what to do. We don't say, you need to get a divorce, you need to go to the police, but we try to help them see what is happening in their relationship so that they are able to make the decision that's right for them.
As you're saying all of this, I'm curious, you're talking about going into the schools. I mean, because I love what you just said there, so my question's related to that kind of logic. What have you found both, you know, what do you know from either empirical evidence or just being in this day to day and like becoming an expert in this field, so to speak? What makes someone be an abuser? What makes someone want to control another person?
That I don't think I can answer. We have had a man come in who works with offenders to try to explain that. And honestly, there's so many factors at play, whether they were abused as a child, whether they have never, you know, emotionally matured to a place where they can have an equal relationship with another human being. Going back to your initial part of that question about being in the school, I think what we try to focus on is helping kids identify what is healthy in a relationship. Like when we're with the sixth and seventh graders, we're not talking about boyfriend-girlfriend relationships. You know, usually we ask them, who in this room is in a relationship? And some kid invariably raises their hand and they're like, I love my dog. We're like, perfect. Like, let's talk about, you know, a healthy way to treat your dog. And you're in a relationship with your best friend. Maybe some of them are starting to date, but having them have conversation around how they would want to be treated. And sometimes you will see them make that leap in a like helpful but sad way about like, so when mom and dad have this interaction, that's not healthy. And then we kind of, let's talk after class kind of thing. But then as I said, that curriculum progresses to by eighth grade, ninth grade, we're talking about teen dating violence and what that looks like and what to avoid.
But I also, like, even what you just said there is super insightful in the sense of what I just practically got out of that too, which I love, is, you know, starting with children, even if they're not in that romantic relationship, you know, if they have a pet, it's like establishing what's the right way to treat others, whether others are humans or animals, or it's a really like foundational way to start to teach your child to candidly just be a good person and be respectful and kind, and you know, what are all these qualities that we inherently know are the way that we should be behaving. But oftentimes, you know, if the child's allowed to abuse the dog or smack the dog or what, you know what I mean? I can see those things naturally carrying over from relationship to relationship. So it's interesting how you kind of ask, you know, because I was thinking it's kind of weird to say to a four-year-old, like, are you in a relationship? Yeah. You know, and it may not be romantic, but they probably have a dog at home or something, you know, where they can start to pick up
quality ways to interact in relationship with their parents.
Totally.
How do they want to be treated by their parents and vice versa? And I do feel like, you know, social media gets a bad rap, but we do see that there is an erosion of kids' ability to kind of judge what's an appropriate way to interact in person, because so much of their interaction, particularly with the opposite sex, is happening via text. And so this exercise we do with them where we are talking about what's flirting, what's sexual harassment. When I first saw the slide we were going to use, I thought, well, of course, it's so obvious. But there was some real grappling happening with kids as they're like, well, can't I keep telling her I think she's really great looking? It's like, well, no, once she tells you not to, you need to stop. Which is a very different like one-on-one reaction than like text. But another thing is they don't think, not they, I don't want to overgeneralize, but this generation is coming up with a lot of exposure around sexting and pretty young ages. And I think that's something that parents have no idea about, they don't want to know about. It's really uncomfortable for them to talk about, but they need to.
Boy, I remember when my mom, I mean, this is going back, but, you know, my school started, you know, where I went to school, shout out to McDonough. They started sex education in, it was lower school. I think it was fourth grade. It could have been second grade, like just slowly talking about it. And I remember my mom having like a book and like sitting down with me to talk to me about
the birds
and the bees and that stuff.
Shout out to your mom.
Like, it was kind of weird or whatever, but yeah, I remember that starting kind of early and all. What I want to bring it back to two things as we, you know, round out this particular conversation. And I don't know if you guys all focus on this, but as I've matured into being an adult and had to grow up in a lot of areas emotionally, candidly, and just and continue to do that, you talked a lot about relationships with others, right? One of the things that I found and I continue to work on, I think oftentimes we can become our own worst critic and be in our head and our ego can get the best of us and all of that. So I think that to me, my personal opinion on all of this, it actually starts with what's the relationship with yourself. And you know, treating yourself, being kind to yourself, and if you can do that and come to a place where you accept who you are and you can understand your value, you then don't necessarily have needs to extract from a relationship from others. So just curious in the classroom if you ever talk about that or if that's even kind of a newer thought to you, but what's the, you know, I would almost want to know, like, if I was sitting down with anyone or a child, like, what's going on in your head? What's the relationship? What are the things that you tell yourself about yourself? And the more that I've been figured out how to wire myself to be positive and stay positive and be kind to myself, and you know, if I make a mistake, not say like, Steven, you're an idiot or any of that, I've been able to have so much joy and success. And then when I'm in a joyful, fulfilled state and I live in an abundant state, that's how I treat others. So it's really important that I've been able to figure out my own head, so to speak, if I'm being honest with you.
So there was a lot in that question, and I would say in all of the curriculum in the schools that we're doing, there is an element of that, like, where are you starting from and how do you respect the other person you're in relationship with it or in conversation with, and how can the person on the other side of that relationship sort of demand to be treated in a fair and respectful way. We are not counselors at Response. We're not therapists trained. We do have great resources that we connect people with. We're like a really big connector agency. So we are connecting people with financial resources, with housing. Well, that's coming directly from us. And with therapy services. We are running a support group right now that has, I think, 8 survivors in it, and it's focused on trauma recovery and empowerment. And so a huge part of that 10-week curriculum is empowering the people. It's all women in that support group by choice. in you know, how to recognize what they need and how they have not been getting what they need, and how to be fulfilled as an individual so that hopefully they will not go back into abusive relationships in the future, and to maybe understand how they ended up in that relationship in the first place. Because a lot of people that we talk to are so surprised, and they will say, like, I would be the last person you would imagine would be ever in an abusive relationship. Like, I am strong, I feel really good about myself, and yet. So there is an element of, like, how do you be happy in yourself? How do you get what you need from within? But there is, I feel like there's a teensy bit of victim blaming in that. Like, if you're just happy in yourself, this won't happen. Because these people that do practice offending behaviors are usually really, really savvy. Like I said earlier, you know, that abuse is not going to happen on day one. It might not even happen on year two. It may be years and years in, but they have been grooming their partner that whole time and figuring out what they can get away with and gradually escalating. So, you know, I think a lot of times when people say, I'm the last person you can imagine, I'm like, yeah, and you're also the first, because it's not about you. It's about this other person who did this to you.
It's really insightful response to what I was sharing, and that's why I appreciate so much the opportunity to be with you, because this is helpful for me, even in a micro, to, you know, just have a better perspective on everything. And I think that, you know, what you just said there is something I'm going to really have to ponder, you know, and think about.
I think I just want to add one thing about the uniqueness of doing this work in this valley. I think most people have heard of Aspen. It's like home of the rich and famous. It's beautiful. People seem on the surface to be really happy, yet we have a super high suicide rate in this valley. And something that one of our city council members, I was in a meeting with, and he called it the happiness paradox, where you look around and you think that everyone else is so happy here. Like, how could you not be so happy? It's so beautiful. We live in such a gorgeous place that if you are struggling, it's really hard to reach out for help. And so I think there's a bit of this head in the sand from people not experiencing relationship violence that it couldn't happen here. You know, I look around, it's so beautiful, it couldn't be happening here. And then a head in the sand on the side of the person who is the victim saying, I must be the only one experiencing this here because everyone else looks so happy. And so I'm afraid to reach out because there's something wrong with me, that it's just happening to me. Or I'm afraid to reach out because it's such a small community and everyone else is so happy, they're gonna look down on me for having this experience. And it's the extreme of that is people who are dying by suicide in this valley because they feel like everyone else has got it dialed, why don't they? So I think it's something that as a community we really need to think about, and that's why I'm really happy that our outreach efforts seem to be making headway. More people are coming to us, not because there's more violence happening, but because more people are aware that we're here. I think the Me Too movement has made a big impact on people feeling like it's okay to come forward, and I'm grateful for that. My board is very comfortable now going and talking about our success stories and talking about the fact that this happens in this valley. So, yeah, progress.
Well, look, tremendous progress. Even in, if we close it there with what you had just shared, there is one other question I do want to ask you on a practical level. But what you just shared there is probably one of the biggest macro points that I've realized as I've come into adulthood, so to speak, is that, number one, and I mean this respectfully for everyone, like, as humans, we're wired very kind of the same way. And there are, while we all are kind of have our uniquenesses, there are a lot of core things that go on in our mind and how we're wired that are similar. And I think we naturally have a need to obviously want to be connected. I mean, that's a whole point of like evolution, the human race, and how we've been able to thrive and have communities and family and all of that. Look out for others, have other people look out for ourselves. Yet, and I find this so true of myself, you know, when I can get depressed, sad, upset, it's when I feel like the problems that I'm facing, whatever they are mine alone. Mm-hmm. And like no one else has ever, you know, faced with this, experience it, whatever. And I think if there's nothing else that we bring in, a lot of people listening to us probably already know that, but just a little bit of reinforcement is that we're never alone. And it's so rare that the very minute circumstances of your problem or issue or the thing that's bothering you, whether it's related to violence, domestic violence, or some other issue that you're having, financial, whatever it is, it's just not that unique. And the best thing that I think you can do, what that I found, is to talk to other people that are either friends, family, or just whoever it is, because you start to realize as soon as the other person says, oh, you know, I'm having that same issue, or mm-hmm. I was faced with that, the moment that we're pulled out of this, it's not just me, like I'm normal, like everyone has problems, is so true. And then, you know, I'm kind of getting on a soapbox here, but I think this whole notion of, you know, everyone else has their shit together and everyone else is perfect, it's the absolute opposite of that. You know, everyone deals with problems, everyone has crap going on, and you're not alone in this.
And that's why I'm excited about our upcoming storytelling event. We've got four or five survivors who are going to tell their stories at the Wheeler Opera House on October 17th. I don't know when this is going to air, but
we'll get it out before then. Okay. This is good. Put me on
but
a deadline.
I think it's that, like, hearing someone who's of your community talk about something that happened to them, but that they've moved through and beyond. And we're talking about it being like survivors who are now thrivers. You know, so this could happen to you, but this recovery, this thriving can also happen after you've gone through something terrible.
I think it's a really, really positive way to explain it. I think people a lot of times like to see, either they see themselves in other people or they see they're inspired, you know, just, I think that as a format is amazing, kind of like problem solution, mm-hmm. so to speak, is really inspirational and great. I want to, for anyone that's listening, if they want to learn more, have more information, you mind talking about how they could find out more info, your website?
Sure.
How would you direct people?
Yeah, so our website is responsehelps, like we are helping people, helps.org. And you can donate there. You can go find out what our resources are. We have a little 4-minute video that includes some interview with survivors that's on our website. And then we have our crisis line, which I mentioned, which is available 24/7, and that's 925-SAFE, so 970-925-SAFE. And then our office number is 920-5357.
I want to round out, I'm kind of maybe going a little bit out of order because I've loved everything we've done, but the question that's still slipping my mind is on a really practical level. Can you talk, you know, I know that a lot of nonprofits are always trying to figure out how to kind of optimize their board, how to transition their board over time. You know, you had mentioned to me when we were just chatting one-on-one about how, you know, your organization, like many, gets started, you know, in a certain way with the founder of the nonprofit. They run, they probably have an initial board that's been there for potentially years, decades, et cetera. They bring in someone with professional experience running a nonprofit like yourself and want to take it to the next level. What are the things that either you've done or that you would recommend that someone who's coming in at that stage where you came into would do with their board, like in terms of maybe term limits or just other expectations from the board to go into this transition?
Sure, yeah. My last position, I spent 7 years like cruising around the Southwest advising executive directors and boards, so I had a lot of experience coming into that. I'm a firm believer in term limits, which Response had just instituted a couple years before I started. So after my first board meeting, our last founding board member transitioned off, and it was sad to see her go because she's amazing, but she stayed involved as a non-board member, which I think is the healthy progression, right? So that an organization can evolve. And I would say that Response at 36 years is in a mature organizational phase, yet also a growth phase. So it's this, like, we've stabilized, but we've added this big new program. So we're kind of doing both at the same time. So I consciously made an effort to have a board of workers. So it's not a working board, they're a governance board. They kind of stay at the high level, but they're in and of the community. They have jobs that are in some way related. We have some people in law enforcement and therapy, in the local chamber. We have a pastor. We have people who've had personal experience, either them or family members, with the issues that we work on. And I think that they all bring really diverse perspectives to the work. The one area that we have not had success is about 45% of our clientele are from the Latino community, and we have no Latinos on our board. And that's something that most nonprofits in the Valley struggle with. Generalizing, people of that community have multiple jobs, and they tend to have long commutes. They might be working up here and living somewhere more affordable. So Getting them involved in board service is a challenge, but it's something that I think is so crucial to be truly representative of our clientele that that's, you know, a goal of mine that we'll continue to work towards. And another is just training the board as to what you really expect of them. So my board has had trainings on board governance, on financial management, but I think what they find most impactful is at least once a year we do an exercise where they practice with each other their elevator speech. Like why are you, individual board member, involved with response? You have 1 minute to tell a random person at a cocktail party why it's important to you. So it's not my elevator speech. It's not the canned, this is what you say about response. Like, you personally, why do you care about this? And that is, I think, the thing that will get us the furthest in expanding awareness and funding for the organization and the community.
Wow. That is the golden nugget. That's incredible.
Well,
I have never had, no, I mean it. I mean, all the stuff that you, on the practical side of just operating the organization has been incredible. And the first two or three things you said about the board, amazing. But that last one there, that to me is gold. I've never had an organization tell me, or I've seen that they're essentially training their board with an elevator, you know, or trying to, yeah, you know, have them understand what the elevator pitch is.
Well, and it's great because they do it one-on-one. Like, I do it with you,
yeah,
and then we do it for 2 minutes, 1 minute each, and then you shift and you go to somebody else. And if you're standing in the background, you see that their spiel evolves as they hear, like, so I would hear what you say, and then I'd say, okay, I'm going to add a little bit of that when I talk to this next person. So after they've done it 12 times, 10 times, they're much better at it. Like, they've got more content, but they're also much more comfortable doing it.
Sure.
And they've said, we want to do that at least once a year. That's really important.
This is amazing. I'm going to figure out how to work this in with Charity Charge too, for like, you know, our, you know,
your sales people. Pitch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and for everyone that's connected to Charity Charge in a meaningful way, right? It's like getting that across. That's awesome. I love it.
It's hard to do in a minute though.
Yeah.
I
can do it in a minute, but yeah, I got to make sure get everyone on the same page. This is wonderful. You know, for everyone that was listening along, this was an interview with Shannon Meyer, the executive director for Response. And if you're interested in finding more, responsehelps.org. We'll put links to that and their phone number in the show notes as well. But this was really tremendous. It's wonderful to be here in Aspen, to have the opportunity to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to learn about our organization. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.